Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good Sunday morning, and welcome to Hot Topics, a presentation of Hot 99.5's Community Affairs Department on Duval's Only R&B. Here's Julie Morgan.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another new edition of Hot Topics. I'm Julie Morgan. Today's topic, mental health. Earlier this month, we spoke to Mental Health America, a support and advocacy organization. Today, we're talking about the mental health of college students. Are you a college student experiencing some issues? Or are you the parent of a student and you feel something just isn't right? Hopefully, the information shared today will help. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Andy King. He's the director of the Counseling Center at the University of North Florida. This is part one of our conversation. Look out for part two next week. Dr. King, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Obviously, we're here to talk about anxiety, depression in students. Mm-hmm. But first of all, let's define what is depression.
Depression is a kind of a global term in terms of people saying, I feel sad. But being sad is a normal emotion, and sadness is not depression. Usually depression is this reduction of energy, motivation. It includes what we call anhedonia, which means what you used to enjoy, you no longer enjoy. So if you enjoyed putting puzzles together, you just don't want to do it. So depression is more than just feeling sad. It's feeling as if you're in a hole. And whereas your arms used to be able to, you feel like you could move them, you don't even feel like moving them. People who are depressed tend to want to stay in bed, and they start to neglect their daily activities. So, you know, most people, they're going to take a shower every 24-hour period. Someone who's depressed, they'll stop bathing. They'll stop eating. Now, some of these symptoms, the depressed person goes to the extreme. So a depressed person will either kind of stop eating or they'll start to overeat. They'll either get insomnia and sleep less and less and less, or they'll sleep more and more and more. But either way, they're not eating the standard 2,000 calorie diet. They're not sleeping the standard 8 to 9 hours a day. They've gone off into some kind of extreme. We tend to look for those kind of things. They're no longer having fun. They don't enjoy engaging people. They start to self-isolate. So you see a lot of these behaviors that are indicative of someone who's depressed.
Based on the information that you just mentioned, do they know that they're depressed?
That's a good question. Our culture has made it more difficult. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you couldn't Google the symptoms of depression, and now you can. The clinical words I would use have gotten into the cultural language. So it's easy for someone to say, oh, I'm depressed. Well, they're not really depressed. You know, we tend to look for the markers for depression in terms of impairment in some normal activity. So the person who has a job that they enjoy, that they've been, you know, paid for, that might even be their livelihood, they stop going, or they cut out early, or instead of, you know, being sick every couple of months because, you know, you caught a cold, you're sick every week. You're missing days at work. In the student, they start to miss class. They start to turn in assignments late. They start to not turn in assignments all year. They neglect their job or their studies or their families. So, you know, our regular behavior, what we consider normal behavior, is we go to work, we eat, we sleep, we play. And depressed people stop doing those things or significantly reduce or change them.
But what another person possibly have to point that out to the depressed individual? that they've stopped doing those things because it's something that may not click for them.
Yeah. 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 And sometimes I think people have to say, hey, you know, you missed work again. Or, you know, and so it does get pointed out. Some people, they become more aware of it themselves. I mean, it can happen both ways. Sometimes others point it out. Usually the person has to be pretty close to you. They have to know that it is not your normal routine to sleep 20 hours out of 24 hours. You know, there are some people who like to sleep, you know. But if I see a person going from a normal sleep pattern of 8 to 10 hours, and then all of a sudden they're doing 15 to 16 hours, I have to be in the home to notice that. And then I'll point it out. But, you know, our professors point things out. For the students who live in our residence halls, you know, the RAs, hey, you know, I stopped by the student's room, you know, a lot last semester. And now when I stop by, you know, I couldn't get them to do squat. I can't get them to decorate their door. I can't get them to talk to me about the movie. I can't get them to do anything. So that happens. Now, a lot of people start to also recognize that something's gone wrong. Probably one of the more telltale signs is they start thinking about things that they have not thought about before. So a student who's done well, you know, they've come, their freshman year was great, good grades. All of a sudden, their sophomore year, they say, yeah, I don't want to go to school anymore. Well, okay, maybe you're not right for college. Maybe you tried it and you're done. Okay, that's fine. Maybe you want to do something else. Or is it you're somehow depressed? And you know, depression isn't this thing that is in and of itself, which is a weird way of saying it, but depression is the result of things. Mm-hmm. You know, if a person who finds themselves contemplating drastic measures, you know, that's a sign that mental health is being compromised. You know, I think one thing that, and I'm always a little hesitant to talk about this.
Sure.
You know, if I say I'm thinking about suicide, that's a significant thought. Now, I'm also here to say, because humans have this ability to be self-aware, unlike a lot of the animals on the planet, we know we're going to die. That's kind of unique to us. To contemplate our own demise is pretty commonplace. You know, people think, oh, well, I'm going to die one day and I'm going to want to leave this to my kids, or I want to leave this to my legacy. But if someone says, you know, life is so horrible, I'd rather not be here than be here. Now, what I would call that, that's kind of passive, but it's kind of a step that says something's up, something needs to be addressed, something's wrong. That given, you know, the person's age, they might have 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years of possible life left. So when people start thinking about suicide, even in a passive way, I think that's a sign that it needs to be addressed. I don't get terribly worked up about people passively thinking about that. I get more concerned when they start forming plans, they start assembling the things they need to enact that plan. Those plans get more clear, more precise, more specific. When we're at that stage, then we need that treatment to come along to an appropriate treatment. And sometimes that means intensive treatment. Sometimes that means weekly appointments. Sometimes that means a combination of that plus medication. On occasion, it means hospitalization. Usually hospitalization is best when the person is in some kind of psychotic episode. As long as you and I can have a good conversation, a frank conversation, and we can contract for safety, and at least until the next time we talk, and we have a safety plan in case that the thoughts occur between then I'm not thinking about this person has to go to the hospital just because they thought about suicide. I wish there were hard and fast rules to this, but they're really not. Depression is somewhat unique to the individual who has it. It looks different in women than it does in men. Absolutely.
Oh, wow. Okay, so let's talk about that because that's shocking. Mm-hmm. How does it look different and why does it look different?
Well, part of it is cultural expectations for men and women are different. So in men, it tends to manifest it in terms of anger and frustration. In women, it tends to manifest itself a little bit differently in terms of maybe more frustration. Men who get depressed start to act out. And it's pretty clear that the research shows that women are more likely to think about suicide and attempt suicide. Men tend to be more successful at suicide because they always choose more lethal means. Men tend to use handguns. Well, you know, once a handgun is fired, there's no saying, oops, I need to pull that bullet back. Whereas women tend to use things like pills. Well, if I get a person to the ER fast enough, I can get that stomach pumped. There's Narcan. There's all these kinds of medicines that doctors, you know, can save the person because, you know, the effect is not as immediate as, you know, a handgun. So men are, and women are a little bit different in terms of how they do it. Suicide is always an impulsive act. If you can get them through the moment, you can avert it.
I would have never thought that. An impulsive act.
Yeah.
Because it seems like if someone is planning something, if they're getting together the things that they need to do this act,
right,
it doesn't seem impulsive.
Right. They are planning, but you can't do that in a vacuum. If people notice that you're giving away things that you need, like, here's my car. Well, don't you have work in the morning? Don't you need your car to go to work? No, I won't be needing that. Then your friend goes, hold on, back the truck up here a little bit. Huh? Why why aren't you going to work? Well, I just don't feel right. Okay, well, now we're all automatic. We're already talking, why aren't you feeling well? Well, I just don't feel like it's worth it anymore. Well, come on. People like you. People depend on you. People want you around. What do you mean it's not worth it? You know, are you not having fun? No, I haven't had fun in years. Okay, now we're saying, okay, I need to get you some help. I need you to get to talking to somebody. You know, we talk about suicide and being a permanent solution to a temporary problem. So a lot of times, if we can address that temporary problem, the suicide ideation dissipates. Now, it might return again, but then the person says, hold on, I'm starting to feel this way. What do I need to do to take care of myself?
Hot 99.5, keeping you up to date with what's happening in the community. This is Hot Topics on Hot 99.5.
Another thing I said that we wanted to talk about is anxiety. Mm-hmm. What is anxiety? Because it seems like that can just manifest itself at any given moment, at any time of the day, based on what you're doing.
Absolutely. So just like depression, being sad on occasion is normal. If a friend of yours dies and you feel sad, that's normal. I expect you to feel sad and feel grief. And I expect that grief, depending on the significance of that person, to last weeks, months. You know, if it's a spouse, it may be years. But that's normal. So anxiety is also normal. If you're driving your car and you're doing 50 in a 25 and you pass a cop and you're not anxious, either you are a cop or you know, something's really wrong. So there are things in life that cause us anxiety. Students come to us and say, oh, I got test anxiety. Everybody has test anxiety. That's why, you know, it's a test. And so do we always feel completely prepared for every test? No. So we always have anxiety about it. Now, anxiety can increase to levels that impair function. So that's the difference between being sad and being depressed. So we talk about being anxious or having an anxiety disorder. Most people know the classic ones, claustrophobia, things like that, where a panic is induced. Probably one of the telltale signs of a panic disorder is the person shows up at the ER and they're telling the nurse or the doc, I'm having a heart attack. And you know, they listen to the heart, they take the blood pressure, and they take some blood, and they run all these tests, and they go, you're not having a heart attack. I don't know what it is, but that's not it. But anxiety does manifest itself at the panic level very viscerally. And it's usually because there is something causing that anxiety in that person's life, but they haven't connected it yet. you know, somebody's boss comes into the break room and says, hey, guys, we're not doing so well this quarter. I'm going to have to lay some people off. Okay. Everybody's going to get anxious, right?
Right.
That's normal. Anxiety, but if it's elevated, we, again, stop doing the things we need or want to do. Okay. So if I'm agoraphobic, I'll stop getting in my car and going to the grocery store because I'm afraid of being out there. That's the anxiety that needs treatment.
Let's talk about how students are affected by being depressed and anxious. It seems like the first thing that comes to my mind when I think about a student being depressed, possibly a freshman, first year away from home, first time away from home, and you just don't know what to do.
Right. So that's part of the assessment, is we kind of find out what's the history on this person. Is it the first time away from home? And there's a difference. You know, are there folks here in Jacksonville and they've come to UNF and, you know, it's a 20-minute drive? Or is this student from Atlanta, Georgia, and they've come to Jacksonville, you know, on a scholarship, and they are, I mean, there's no, hey, can I hitch a ride home? It's none of that. So the distance sometimes tests their ability to be self-sufficient, you know. So the stress of coming to the college, the difference between someone who commutes versus someone who lives on campus can be different. Different people are prepared differently. I think back when I was a kid, I went to summer camps in another state. So for me to go to another place and stay a few weeks, it was the next step. It didn't bother me so much. But I had friends in college. I mean, they grew up in Memphis. They went to college in Memphis. If they left Memphis, you know, it was, you know, for their graduate program or some job when they were in their mid-20s. The stresses are different depending on the person. Again, they will have normal homesickness. That's pretty standard. Usually goes away with time. They start connecting with friends on campus. They get more involved on campus. It tends to go away. There is some natural anxiety with new situations, as it is with all of us. However, let's say we get into this and the first semester grades come in and we have a student who did well on their SATs, you know, they did well on their ACTs, and all of a sudden they got straight C's with a D, something is up. So we have impaired academic function. Occasionally, it'll happen where the student, they get to their room, they get set up in their room, and then they never leave their room. Now, you know, we've got a lot of online stuff, but it's not all online. So
how does that happen?
Well, that's an example of an anxiety disorder. Once they kind of got nested, so to speak, and they had their all their things with them, you know, they couldn't bear to part from those things that they brought with them. And it's not necessarily just things. It's they've created their home away from home, but they can't get away from that. You know, that's when ideally the students are coming into the counseling center. We have an arrangement so that even when we're closed for the day, they can still call our number and they can still get connected, at least by phone, to a counselor, a helpline person, even when we're closed.
Tell me this, do the professors possibly refer the students because they see something is happening? Mm-hmm. Or do the students realize something is happening and they say, you know what, I need to take advantage of the counseling center on campus?
I'll say both. I think we're more likely to get faculty, staff, residents, life, you know, RAs, suggesting to students to come in or walking the students over. However, we tend to be very approachable. And I'm not just talking about UNF. Every good counseling center has these things. We have a web presence. We have a social media presence. I mean, you can like us on Facebook and Instagram and, you know, and you can see who does the work here. You can see what we do. So a lot of students take advantage of that, and they can do their research online even before they come in. And then once they think, okay, this is something I want to try, I've learned about confidentiality, I've learned about who I could meet with, I think I have an idea of what I want, so I call and I make an appointment. They have an appointment, they walk in. We also have set it up so that we have at least one therapist kind of at their desk taking care of sundry items, and So if a student walks in distress, occasionally we'll have parents call in. For example, the parents know something. Parents calls in and says, well, I'd like to get my son or daughter in. Now, since they have to consent to treatment, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when most college students are 18, so mom can't make them go to counseling. That's against the law. That's forced treatment. So the adult, the legal adult, has to consent to treatment. So usually we say, ma'am, would you put your son or daughter on the phone, and I'm happy to make an appointment with them. But they're the ones who have to do it, because every mental health person will say, if I don't have some cooperation from my patient or my client, we're not going to do much. Mm. I mean, a psychiatrist will say, hey, I've got a great medicine for you, but I'm not going to be there every morning to put it in your hand and watch it go in your mouth. You've got to do that. The nice thing about it, mental health is really a collaborative, cooperative process between the person and their provider. The person has more control over this process in mental health than they do in physical health. I mean, if I have a heart attack, I'm not even conscious. You know, I got people working on me and they're just doing what they think they need to do, and I don't get a say about it until I wake up the next day. So, but in mental health, you tell me what we're going to talk about today. Now, I'm going to connect it to the signs and the symptoms and the progress, but you have a big role in what we're going to be doing.
Who's more likely to reach out for help, a man or a woman?
Women, absolutely. Every time we study this, approximately two-thirds of our clients are women. And women are better help seekers. Women tend to be more collaborative. Culturally, we encourage women to do that. Men, we say, you got to be strong and independent and pull yourself up by your shoes and be a man and suck it up. And unfortunately, our boys hear that, and then they keep doing it, and sometimes it's too late. I encourage our male clients to come in because it's good helping seeking skills. I say, you know, if you had a son who had this problem, what would you tell your son? Would you tell him to suck it up? Would you tell them to go get some help? You love your son, so you can say, go get help. You know, you'd be pleading with them. So I say, apply the same standard to yourself. And to that point, I'm very conscious of that. Sometimes when people seek out counseling, they want a counselor they feel they can relate to. So we ask, would you feel better if you had a male counselor or a female counselor? And I've had women tell me they want a male, and I've had women tell me they want a female. We say, Is it better for them to be a little older, maybe have a little gray hair, or do you want somebody kind of young and more with it? I ask them, to the degree I can, if your counselor was a person of color, would that help you? And sometimes they go, yeah, sometimes they don't, and I'll do my best, because I want them to feel as comfortable as possible with that other person, because what I need to happen is to deal with anxiety, to deal with depression, which, you know, when you look at it, are the common colds of mental health. I need that relationship to flourish. I need rapport. I need a therapeutic trust. So those questions can be asked and answered and understood.
This is part one of my conversation with Dr. King. Join us next week for part two. In the meantime, you can look up the services offered by the University of North Florida by going to their website, unf.edu, and search Counseling Center at the top of the page. Thank you for joining us today on Hot Topics. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Hot Topics on Hot 99.5. Hot Topics is a presentation of Hot 99.5's Community Affairs Department. For more information about the program you just heard, visit myhot995.com, then click on Hot Cares. And join us again next Sunday morning at 6:30 a.m. for another edition of Hot Topics on Duval's only R&B, the new Hot 99.5.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.